From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review the mystery thriller Serenity, starring Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway. The Kid Who Would Be King is written and directed by Joe Cornish, and King of Thieves, which is a British drama starring Michael Caine, Jim Broadbent, and Tom Courtney. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Peter Rayner of the Christian Science Monitor and Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast. We begin with Serenity, a dramatic thriller written and directed by Stephen Knight. It stars Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway. It tells the story of a fishing boat captain with a mysterious past, which, of course, comes back to haunt him when his ex-wife turns up and asks him to save her and their son from a violent new husband.
My husband is joining me here the day after tomorrow. I told him that I would charter a boat for fishing tuna. I want you to take him out on your boat. Let him get drunk. Then drop him in the ocean for the sharks. In return, I will give you $10 million cash.
Serenity, what'd you think, Christy?
I'm so happy I get to describe this movie and talk about it today with you guys. I'm going to try really hard to describe it and not spoil its many massive plot twists and its many delights that are in store for you. This movie is nuts. It is insane. It is terrible, but it must be experienced. It is so fun. And it reminds me of movies like The Book of Henry and Collateral Beauty that are so insane with these incredible casts that are totally overqualified for this stuff, and you wonder, what are they doing here? Starting with Matthew McConaughey. He plays this fishing boat captain who is damaged and chain smoking and hard drinking, and he's an Iraq war veteran living on this remote, idyllic island. He wants to hide. He wants the quiet of this place. And Anne Hathaway is the ultimate film noir femme fatale, comes sauntering in through the door.
The only
bar on the entire island, the mysterious island of Plymouth. And she gives him this proposition, as we just heard. Jason Clarke is the horribly abusive husband. Everybody in this is a total film noir type. They're all the arch cliches. The music, as we heard in that clip, is really melodramatic. It's totally nuts. And then Stephen Knight, who wrote and directed Locke, which was an excellent piece of kind of narrative trickery, kind of yanks the rug out from us halfway through. And then he yanks the entire thing at the end and kind of waves a rug around in the air like, ha-ha, see, this rug used to be underneath your feet and now it's not. And the twists are not nearly as profound as he seems to think.
What do you think, Peter?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fan of, like, really crazy, nutty movies. Yeah. I don't know if I would say it's a good movie. It's sort of intriguingly bad. Matthew McConaughey has sort of become, like, sort of, you know, A-list Nick Cage in making these kind of bizarre movies where he's, you know, you're not quite sure what he's up to. The role he plays here, you know, he's searching for this big tuna. It's kind of like he's like a nut brain Ahab trying to land this gigantic tuna that he's named Justice. And you know, a lot of this film, you know those commercials that McConaughey does for Lincoln?
Yeah,
cars?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like
very atmospheric.
Yeah,
commercials.
I mean, it's kind of like it's sort of in that
taking
realm
the
of
ferry to the
right. You know,
location.
It's kind of like head scratching time. But you know, it's worth seeing. I think the cast is pretty terrific. It's beautifully shot. It's not as quite as intriguing as I think they want it to be, and it's more confusing than anything else in the end. But it's definitely something that should be experienced.
Yeah. With friends.
Diverting, yeah. As they say.
Diverting, right.
Serenity is rated R. It's in wide release. Stephen Knight, the writer, director, Matthew McConaughey, and Anne Hathaway star. The Kid Who Would Be King is a family adventure, modern-day spin on the King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table legend. Joe Cornish wrote the screenplay and directs. It stars Louis Ashbourne's Circus as Alex, a young boy who stumbles upon a sword stuck in a block of concrete with a mysterious Latin inscription.
It means Sword of Arthur, son of Tintagel. Who's Tintagel?
It's a place. An island off the coast of Cornwall. Some people say it's where King Arthur was born.
Alex, what if you're the only person who could have pulled that sword out? What if it's the sword in the stone?
The kid who would be king, Christy?
I like this a lot, and a lot more than I expected that I would at the outset, given that it's January. It's really fun, and it's got kind of a great kid energy about it, but then also real adventures and real dangers and real stakes in a way that reminded me of some films from the 80s like Time Bandits and The Goonies, where kids were in actual trouble and the film does not coddle them or condescend to them. They've got to figure it out for themselves and work together. Louis Ashburn Circus, son of Andy Circus, is really good in this. He's got a really lovely natural kind of screen presence. I also really very much liked Dean Chamu as his kind of goofy, awkward best friend. It's a good cast. It is the Sword and the Stone legend, but in a modern day setting that feels accessible and feels real. Patrick Stewart and Rebecca Ferguson class up the cast quite a bit. Angus Emery plays the younger version of Merlin, who's kind of the smartest guy in the room, but also really goofy and really impatient. I liked him a lot. If you're thinking about bringing kids, just FYI, there is some potentially scary imagery in here. There are these giant cavalries of flaming skeletons on horseback, full of armor, and they're very menacing. So there is some kind of scary imagery here for very little kids. But I would say if you have kids who are about 8 or 9 and they're knowledgeable about all the Merlin stuff, they might dig it.
And that might help, having a little bit of background into it.
My son did. Yes, he liked it a lot.
It's rated PG. Peter, what'd you think of The Kid Who Would Be King?
Well, not quite as much. I mean, you referenced Time Bandits, Chrissy. I wish this film had a kind of, you know, nuttier, visionary, I wish Terry Gilliam, you know, in his prime had sort of stepped in, or more to the point, John Borman, who did Excalibur. But, you know, that's probably asking for too much. I think it's a good conventional film with a little bit too many life lessons piled into it. I mean, it's actually what the Arthurian five things that you need to do to be a better person that's referenced in the film. But, you know, Andy Serkis's kid is... I think well on his way to becoming the Gollum of the next generation if he wants to be.
Have we seen him in anything else? Do you know?
Yeah, so he is a voice of one of the characters in this recent live action or performance caption film that Andy Serkis directed called Mowgli, a recent take on the Jungle Book. Yeah. He's one of the voices of this cute little wolf pup in that. But we should mention also, Joe Cornish wrote and directed this, and he did Attack the Block, which was a really fun kind of mishmash, like modern day sci-fi alien kind of dark comedy, which gave us John Boyega, who is now Finn in the Star Wars movies. And I really like the energy that he brings. There's like a rough-hewn kind of like low-tech energy that he brings to these films. I like very much.
He also co-wrote The Adventures of Tintin for Spielberg.
All right.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So Joe Cornish. And so it sounds like, Peter, you sort of like the idea of this,
yeah,
but
I mean,
it wasn't,
you know,
executed.
I just took it as a metaphor for the Brexit crisis, actually.
maybe.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah, no, now that
really?
You mention it,
really?
That's a really good point, yeah.
Yeah.
And this is a British, U.S. co-production now?
I guess so,
So there's some Brits as well as Americans in the cast.
Oh,
here.
And of course, Patrick Stewart.
Yeah.
Is Merlin.
Is Merlin. He wears a Led Zeppelin t-shirt, which is a great
literally,
touch.
Literally?
Yeah.
It's
cute.
The Kid Who Would Be King, Joe Cornish, the writer-director, starring Louis Ashburn Circus, Patrick Stewart, Rebecca Ferguson. It's rated PG, and you can see it in wide release. King of Thieves, a British drama, stars Michael Caine, Jim Broadbent, and Tom Courtney. James Marsh directs from the screenplay written by Joe Penhall. Peter.
This is based on an actual robbery that I was not aware of in 2015. It was a robbery in London of a safe deposit institution that cash, gold, and jewelry, tons of money were pulled out of it. Not all of it has come back. Carried out by a bunch of old retired codgers. So you see this film and you think it's sort of like one of these Over the Hill gang movies, except the cast is so amazing that what should be sort of, you know, a not very good heist movie that tries to be all things to all people tonally is definitely watchable because, I mean, listen, I mean, this cast, Michael Caine, who's the leader, Jim Broadbent, cast against type as a bad guy, Tom Courtney, Michael Gambon has this bit role, one of the great actors, yeah. and Ray Winstone. I mean, it's like I kept expecting, you know, Vanessa Redgrave or Glenda Jackson to show up, you know, playing a bank teller. I mean, it's just very bizarre. I guess, you know, you take the work where you get it, but it doesn't really hang together as anything more than a conventional caper movie except for that cast.
Yeah, it's kind of a mishmash of tones, as you say, because it is kind of like the grumpy old men on an adventure movie, and it's also like a one last heist movie, and these are both totally cliched premises yeah. that we have seen time and time again. Of course, these guys could just sit around and just have tea and talk, and that would be enormously watchable right there. They make it watchable, and it's kind of wacky for a while. And then it gets really serious when they all begin yeah. turning on each other.
Yeah,
and
the Dishonor Among Thieves.
Yeah, it becomes a different kind of movie, like all of a sudden. We should mention James Marsh directed this, who is an Oscar winner for the documentary Man on Wire
yeah.
which is
oh,
so
yeah.
excellent yeah. and a really different kind of film. He also did right. The Theory of Everything.
By the way, just a very quick note. When I saw Man on Wire in Sundance, Philip Petit was there to introduce it and tripped on his
President
way up to
Trump
the stage.
Has come out. We take you to the Rose Garden of the White House. We continue with Film Week. Film critic Peter Rayner talking about King of Thieves, a drama starring Michael Caine, Jim Broadbent, Tom Courtney, Ray Winstone, extraordinary cast, Michael Gambon as well. The film directed by James Marsh, written by Joe Penhall. Peter, you're just talking about how tremendous ingredients went into this film, if yeah. not the end result.
Yeah, I mean, it's like having, you know, all top ingredients for a casserole that kind of doesn't quite taste that appetizing. But it's just a tribute to how wonderful these actors are that you can watch this film anyway and sort of get enough involved in it just through the art of acting. And each of the performers' styles are so different from each other, too. You know, there's sort of Tom Courtney is kind of very closed in. He's playing a character who's hard of hearing. Michael Caine. You know, Michael Caine is arguably, you know, one of the two or three greatest actors in movies still. I wish he chose better roles. But on the other hand, he said he was going to retire 10 years ago, and he hasn't. So
yeah, this is very much a Michael Caine role that we have seen before, but he's so excellent at it. And there's yeah. some cool old footage at the end
yeah.
of these actors in previous roles. It kind of brings it all full circle.
Oh, that sounds fun. King of Thieves, James Marsh directs, Joe Penhall wrote it. It's rated R. You can see it at the AMC Universal City Walk. The Invisibles, a German biopic starring Maximilian Mauff. Klaus Raefle is the director and co-screenwriter with Alejandra Lopez. Peter, what'd you think of The Invisibles?
Well, it's a fascinating story. There seems to be an endless number of twists on Holocaust narratives, and I hadn't really been too aware of this one, you know, there were 1,700 Berlin Jews who remained in Berlin during the Holocaust, you know, sort of in plain sight. Most of the characters that we see in the film were in safe houses, but they did go out into the streets and so forth. The problem for me with this movie is that it's pretty rocky because it's a docudrama with actors acting out stories that we kept cutting into for either archival footage or voiceover narration, or first-person interviews with the four people who are portrayed in the film, two of whom have since died since the film's been made. So it's kind of like you keep sort of shifting into a different gear, and then you get shifted back again. And the archival stuff and the first-person stuff is so powerful that, you know, it's no fault of the film except in the concept itself that the actors and the dramatizations, I think, just can't live up to that.
It's a very ambitious mishmash. And it took me a long time to get into its rhythms because, like you, I would be so engrossed by the actual people telling their stories. There's so much drama, so much pathos in that. And then it would just jerk into a really nicely, handsomely staged recreation of the events that they are speaking of. And it goes back and forth between the documentary interviews and the recreations of those moments. And ultimately, they do kind of complement each other, but it always feels a little awkward and a little jumpy, but the stories themselves are fascinating. The one young woman who you know, dyed her hair blonde and would go to the movies, the same movie over and over again, just to have some place to go during the day. So there are some very vivid details of how they survived, but ultimately, yeah, it's like maybe it would have been better as one thing or the other.
Yeah.
I'm curious your thoughts just generally about docudrama. I mean, that's sort of what I think of as this genre, the combining of that. Because to me, I find one pulls me out of the other. I feel kind of whipsawed usually.
Yeah, well, that's how I felt here. Because, I mean, it's sort of like if, you know, you're watching Shoah and then they keep cutting in with, you know, like dramatizations of what you're watching. There's no way that even routine archival footage and interviews can't be more powerful than the dramatizations given the subject matter itself.
We're talking about The Invisibles, a German biographical docudrama. Klaus Raefle, the director and co-screenwriter. It's unrated at Lemley's Royal in West Los Angeles, Lemley's Town Center in Encino as well. We have more of Film Week coming your way right here on 89.3 KPCC. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, and I sure hope we're going to see you at the Theater at Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles for the next Film Week Academy Award preview. We'll have our Film Week critics on stage. We'll watch clips from the Oscar-nominated Best Picture nominees. It's going to be a terrific afternoon, Sunday afternoon, February 17th, Theater at Ace Hotel. Get your tickets now. It's sold out last year. You visit kpcc.org/in-person, and I sure look forward to seeing you then. Our next film was actually released a couple of years ago in France, but the documentary now makes its way to the U.S. Jihadists is the film, which is written and directed by Francois Margolin and Lemin Ould Salim. Peter, what'd you think of Jihadists?
Well, it's a powerful movie. It's no great piece of documentary filmmaking, but it's quite revelatory. The filmmaker, particularly Salim, was spent many years following the jihadi occupation of northern Mali, and got to meet with a number of the members of this extreme subset of radical Islam. And films them talking about what they do, and you know it's very hard to watch some of this film because it's quite brutal. You see assassinations and killings and things, you know, on newsreel footage. There's a lot of Salafism propaganda footage that's in the movie too. All of which is, you know, is quite fascinating and quite scary. The other filmmaker. Margolin has said that, you know, his family, many perished in the Holocaust, and that was one of the reasons why he wanted to make this movie, to understand, you know, what these people are like. And he said, you know, just a brief statement about, he says, it's important to listen to what these people have to say because they are not crazy and they have not escaped from psychiatric wards. They are not isolated people. They're people with an ideology, hard to listen to, words that have a hard time hearing, images that are hard to look at. But it's important to know today that these people have decided to wage war on us. So, you know, that's sort of his mission that he states up front in the film.
What do you think of it, Christy?
It's not a particularly good film, per se. It's constructed in just the absolute simplest, rawest way. Just, it's a series of talking heads. And in between the talking heads, the director will explain, sitting at his editing bay, you see his, you know, the monitor behind him where he has worked, explaining his thought process in including certain kinds of footage or whatever, why he has, there's ISIS propaganda footage in here, because I guess they couldn't actually get access to the Islamic State, so they include that to have that component of it. I wish it had been put together a little more artfully. And again, what they're saying is so powerful, what they're saying is quite shocking, but it grows a little repetitive. It's just like one man after another, sitting on the floor, same kind of backdrop behind them of books or whatever's in their living room, and it's kind of dry. And I just wish that there had been more, I don't know, artfulness or craft in compiling it.
It was originally banned in France because they felt it was too, you know, much sort of advocacy for what was being spoken, as you know, that so they contextualized it for the version that we're seeing with these interviews with the filmmakers that put it more into a perspective, you know, that they're not just showing you this stuff and, you know, you decide for yourself.
The film is unrated, although clearly not for kids, given the subject matter. Highly violent subject matter. Jihadist is the film, unrated. It's playing one day, next Thursday, at Lemley's Royal Theater, and one day, next Friday, Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. Jihadist is the film. The German-U.S. co-production action flick Polar stars Mads Mikkelsen and Vanessa Hudgens. It's directed by Jonas Åkerlund. Jason Rothwell wrote the screenplay. Peter, what'd you think of Polar?
Yeah, from Netflix, the company that gave you Roma, we have Mads Mikkelsen as a hired assassin. It's pretty grody to the max, this film. It's ultra violent.
Word I haven't heard in a while.
Well, I'm bringing it back. It's very you know, it's graphic. It's based on a graphic novel, and it's way over the top. You know, in ways that I didn't particularly appreciate. It's funny. I mean, Mikkelsen is playing this you know, great hitman, but he's gone into retirement. But the plot of the film is that he works for a company. There's actually a hitman company that pays pensions. You know, I didn't know that. So, you know,
if you're fortunate enough to reach retirement.
Well, there's the rub, because as you approach 50, you're asked to retire. But the scurvy head of the company, the CEO, decides that he's going to kill off all the assassins before they get to 50 so they don't have to pay out the pension. So Mikkelsen's onto this.
Is that played for comedy or serious?
Well, I think it's hard to tell. I think it's serious, but I was laughing. I guess Liam Neeson was unavailable for this movie, but Mads Mikkelsen, who's also in a film coming up called Arctic.
Arctic next week is Arctic.
Yeah. Polar and Arctic.
Yeah, and Liam Neeson is shortly going to be in a movie called Cold Pursuit. So I guess there's a chill in the air. Yeah,
and Frozen 2, is that coming? Polar, starring Mads Mikkelsen, Jonas Åkerlund is the director. It's unrated. It's streaming on Netflix. Heartlock, a romantic drama starring Alexander Dryman and Leslie Ann Brandt. John Kaufman makes his feature directorial debut and co-wrote the screenplay with Chris Cummings. Christy, what'd you think of Heartlock?
It is okay. It is a solid kind of slow burn prison drama. It covers a lot of territory we have seen many times, many places before, but it's done pretty well for a low budget kind of first film without really any known actors at all. So Alexander Dryman plays this young man who is sent to this Heartlock prison institute, and it's institution rather, and it's in the town where he grew up, and he is there for a series of robberies. The girlfriend he pulled the robberies off with has abandoned him. He is there, and he quickly figures out how to insinuate himself with the guy who is really the enforcer at the prison, is played by Eric Leray Harvey, a very charismatic performance from him. He's the kind of guy who can get a phone and get drugs, and he has a pet cat in his prison cell. But he also figures out a way to sweet talk and then increasingly, you know, legitimately flirt with guard played by Leslie Ann Brandt, who is kind of like a young Halle Berry. And he, you know, increasingly falls in love with her as she falls in love with him. But he's also using her to help him sneak out. And so it's stuff we have seen before, but it's done pretty well. It's okay.
Heartlock is unrated. John Kaufman, the director and co-screenwriter. It's at Lemley's Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. Unacceptable Loss is a mystery thriller starring Tika Sumpter, Jamie Lee Curtis, Ben Tavassoli. It's written and directed by Joe Chappelle. Peter, what'd you think of Unacceptable Loss?
It's unacceptable, Larry. It's all of it. No, I mean, it's not a very good movie. Tika Sumpter is, you know, this former policy advisor, security advisor to the president, who was in charge of you know, ginning the evidence. 150,000 people, Syrians, were nuked that supposedly was, you know, going to solve the war on terror. Jamie Lee Curtis at the time was the vice president, and now, as the movie begins, she's the president. So presumably that nuking worked to her advantage in the polls. But now Libby wants to tell all, but she doesn't have a cell phone. She doesn't have a computer. She's writing a memoir longhand, and she sleeps with a pistol. She knows five languages. There's a guy who's stalking her, and we figure out that it's more than just the usual. He has some political involvement, and it's all very muddled and murky and not particularly interesting or well-directed. The one exception is Jamie Lee Curtis as the president, sheathed in bright white. You know, I mean, she would make a great president. I mean, she's supposed to be the villain, but she's so much more engaging than anybody else in the movie. And the movie's such a malarkey anyway that you kind of go with her and you wish she was in it even more. You know, I mean, between this and Halloween, you know, she's back.
Yeah, which is great to see.
Yeah.
An acceptable loss is at Lemley's Monica Film Center. It's rated R. Tika Sumpter starring, Joe Chappelle, the writer-director. Dead Aunt, an adventure comedy starring Tom Arnold, Sean Astin, and Jake Busey. Ron Carlson, the writer-director. Christy.
This movie is terrible, but not even in a fun way. At the top of the show, we discussed Serenity, which is terrible, insane, but fun. This is just shoddy and cheap and never funny. It is about this bad 80s hair metal band called Sonic Grave, and they are getting a shot at playing at Coachella, or so they think. And they are in their ramshackle trailer headed through the desert, and they make the mistake of stopping by this one little fruit stand where a Native American has some peyote, and all of a sudden they get attacked by ants. And the ants get bigger and bigger and bigger until eventually it becomes a horror movie, and the ants try to destroy them, and then they fight back. It feels very improvised. It's profane in ways that are lame and cheap. Like, it just feels like people were making things up on the fly as they went along to try to be shocking.
Making up on the ants.
Yeah.
Right. it's so lame. But it does feature exploding ant heads eventually.
Oh, good.
The ants explode.
Dead Aunt is the name of
the
action adventure comedy, written and directed by Ron Carlson. The film is unrated. It's at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. I mean, it's hard when you're talking about a comedic movie about a rock group. You know, Spinal Tap just is unmatched, right?
I mean, there's
really nothing at that level.
We should all just have stopped after Spinal Tap. That is the gold standard.
It is the gold standard.
It took it to
nothing.
11.
Yeah, it took it to 11. I wanted to mention before we break that Robert Redford just announced, he came out for the opening news conference of the Sundance Film Festival. And as you might know, that, you know, he said last year that The Old Man and the Gun would be his final on-screen performance, that the 82-year-old Redford was retiring from acting. And that, of course, film he starred in along with Sissy Spacek. But he said at the news conference at Sundance that he would no longer in future years be coming out, addressing, you know, the press and the audience, wouldn't be introducing films, and that it was time for him to, that he would stop doing that. Now, Peter, I don't know if you're going next week. You used to go every year, though.
Yeah.
And he was a big presence at the festival.
I'm not there this year. He was sort of the grand poobah who showed up and kind of, you know, ruled the roost, either explicitly or implicitly. I don't know what offhand is behind that. I know that when he announced that he was retiring from acting in Toronto, he got besieged with questions about that and not about the Old Man and the Gun movie that he was there to promote. And he said, in retrospect, he regretted saying anything because all the press was about his retirement and not about the movie. This seems to be a separate issue. So, you know, maybe he's just decided to, enjoy life a bit more. He's certainly very active still as a, as a honcho, as a producer. You know, I think he owns half of Park City. I always thought that if the
Sundance... Which is worth a lot more now after Sundance
exactly.
started.
I mean, I always thought if Redford had been a surfer instead of a skier, we would have had the Maui Sundance Film Festival instead of the a Donner Party with movies that Sundance is.
Yeah, and I'm always skeptical. Any actor or director who says she or he is retiring, because you're only one great role away. Well, maybe I'll do one more thing, or one, unless there's severe intervening health issues that would keep someone from doing it, which there's no indication in this case.
No. I mean, and like I mentioned when we were talking earlier, Michael Caine, about 10 years ago said that he was retiring from acting and didn't. Even Jimmy Cagney came back. The only one I think who stuck to it really was Garbo and Cary Grant.
Yeah, so true. We'll continue. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Christy Lemire, Peter Rayner with us. We'll be back very shortly.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Great to have you with us on Film Week. Larry Mantle, joined by critics Christy Lemire and Peter Rayner. Coming up on Sunday, February 17th at the Theater at Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles, it's the 17th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. Our critics will be on stage. We'll see clips of the Best Picture nominees and have members of the audience able to ask questions of our critics. Always terrific. I love the questions that we get from audience members because you're going to be in a sea of film lovers, people who love Film Week and are deeply devoted to films. Last year, sold out at the Ace. So we want you to get your tickets now. Visit kpcc.org/in-person to get your tickets. But, of course, there are many more categories of nominations for the Oscars than we're able to take up in our special Film Week event. So we're going to take up two of the categories that we will not be talking about on February 17th during this next segment of Film Week. The Best Foreign Language nominees are Capernaum, as well as Cold War, Never Look Away, Roma, and Shoplifters. Let's start with the Lebanese drama Capernaum. The film is directed by Nadine Labaki, who co-wrote the screenplay. Christy, you want to start us on Capernaum?
Sure. It is my least favorite of the five nominees in this category, and I feel like this category is incomplete without the inclusion of Burning.
Mm-hmm.
Burning should be in here and is not. And so I sort of feel like it's all null and void. Chuck it all out the window. But
that the L.A. Film Critics' number two film was Burning, wasn't it?
Burning and Shoplifters were both our foreign language picks. Roma was our top film of the year. Was Burning our number two, Peter? Can't remember. Anyway, it's all up there.
It was up there.
There's a lot of love for it. But Capernaum is relentlessly bleak, and it's got some powerful individual moments, but it just feels kind of one note hammering you with the sadness.
I liked it a bit more than that. I think it's a really streetwise, powerful movie in many ways, with an amazing performance by this 12-year-old Zain al-Rafia, who is in the movie for most of the film and really has to scurry to survive and make a living and take care of this baby in the process.
The film is Capernaum, and it is in theaters right now. It's rated R, Oscar-nominated for Best Foreign Language Film. You can see it at Lemley's Glendale Cinema, as well as their Music Hall, their Playhouse, and Monica Film Center locations. Cold War, a Polish romantic drama. This has gotten much love from critics, directed and co-written by Paweł Pawlikowski. What did you think of it, Peter?
I liked the first half of it quite a bit. Pawlikowski did Ida a few years ago, which won the Oscar, and this is his second black and white movie in his native Poland. He spent much of his career growing up in the West. It's a mixed bag because I think once the character in the film defects and the romance between these two tempestuous couples keep going back and forth across countries and times, and it becomes rather clogged with blips of powerful but not entirely sufficient scenes between them. And you get to feel that, you know, particularly Joanna Kulig, I think, is a great actress in this film. And it's one of the best performances I've seen during the year. She sort of looks a bit like Jennifer Lawrence. And there's a little bit of Jean Moreau from Jules and Jim in there, and also kind of a film noir vamp.
I love this movie. It is stunning. It is at the same time compact yet epic. And Pavel Pawlikowski also got a surprise Best Director nomination.
Yeah.
And the film got a cinematography nomination. Joanna Kulig is a total star. It's a big showy role for her. I love this movie so much.
Cold War is the film. It's rated R. It's in selected theaters right now. Never Look Away is a German film. Again, best foreign language nominee. We're talking about all five of them. Tom Schilling and Sebastian Koch star in the film, which is written and directed by Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. You want to start on this one?
Sure thing, yeah. So Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck won the foreign language Oscar about a decade ago for The Lives of Others. And here he is also exploring Germany, in East Germany and West Germany. And it takes place over a long period of time. The film is 3 hours long. It's quite epic, quite sprawling, a very old-fashioned, very beautifully made film. But kind of traditional in a lot of ways, and not my favorite of the bunch either.
Yeah, it's a very straightforward, traditional, conventional movie, overlong, not entirely satisfying emotionally or even on a political level. It's based loosely on the career of the painter Gerhard Richter, although he's not named as such in the film.
It's interesting, there's so many previous winners that are included in this, the slate of film. So it sort of, comes with known figures behind them.
Sure, sure.
A Never Look Away, German film, chosen as nominee for Best Foreign Language Film by the Oscars. It's rated R. It's playing in selected Lemley theaters. Roma, of course, from director Alfonso Cuarón, also nominated in the Best Picture category. We don't need to spend a lot of time on it because we've spoken so much about writer-director Cuarón's film, which is streaming on Netflix, also with the New Art and select Lemley theaters. But Peter, quick thought on Roma in this category. Is it possible that it hurts it in the Best Picture category?
It's quite possible. It's also possible that it could win Foreign Film and Best Picture. You know, there's a lot of unprecedented stuff going on with the Oscars this year. My guess is that voters will either decide that, you know, Roma is not Best Picture, really, so we're going to throw all our eggs into the foreign language category. But there's really no way to tell. There have been a lot of strange votes this year. The Mr. Rogers documentary was not nominated. One of the reigning theories is that everybody thought it would be, so they voted for something else. Right. It's like what happened with the Putney Swope plot, you know.
But of course it's the documentary branch of the Academy, which is known for kind of going its own way.
It's putting it charitably.
Christy, what do you think about Roma being in the two categories?
What's interesting with Roma here, though, is that it's up against Cold War. And both are extremely personal, exquisitely crafted black and white masterpieces.
And both directors are nominated for Best Director.
They are. And both come from the director's personal lives. Both were inspired by their youth. Like Cold War is about the director's parents. Roma is about Cuarón's time as a child in Mexico City in the 1970s. So I wonder do those two cancel one another out in that regard? I mean, Roma's a masterpiece. And if you can see it on a screen, go see it on a screen.
Yeah.
Roma, again, streaming on Netflix in selected theaters, rated R. And finally, in the foreign language Oscar nomination category, Shoplifters from Japan, right? Director Hirokazu Koreeda, the film starring Lily Franke, rated R. Christy?
Shoplifters is just subtly devastating. It's so beautiful. It's so lovely, and it's small moments in both its joys and its heartbreaks. It is this slice of life of this family, quote-unquote family, of people living in poverty and sort of stealing day by day just to get by. And the capacity for generosity that they increasingly find that they are capable of, and just the unexpected lovely connections that they make with each other. It's so quietly beautiful. Yeah. It's great.
And a lot to ponder in this film. I mean, it just leaves you with sort of so many questions you can come away with and ask yourself about, you know, the moral dilemmas that are expressed.
Yeah, and a lot of people have said, you know, is this a documentary or a docudrama? And no, it's a scripted, dramatic, acted film, but it's based on something that happens all the time in Japan. It's you know, taken from the headlines, as it were. I know Larry always mentioned what we would like to see nominated in this category. So, I mean, in addition to echoing Christie's Burning, there was a marvelous movie called What Will People Say, a sort of Norwegian-Pakistani film by a first-time woman director, which was absolutely extraordinary. It was one of the best films I saw all year. It came and went. Few people saw it, even among critics. And if the Kino is the releasing company, and you really should check it out because it's just a marvelous film that really deserved better.
The title again?
What Will People Say?
What Will People Say? We were just talking about Shoplifters, five foreign language nominees for the Oscar, Shoplifters from Japan, written and directed by Hirokazu Koreeda. It's rated R and in selected theaters. We have more to talk about on Film Week. Again, as we preview our Film Week Oscar show at the Theater at Ace Hotel coming up next month. Next, we'll talk about the cinematography category. Back in a minute. Coming up, February 17th, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. It's our 17th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview with our film critics on stage. We'll watch on the huge screen at the Ace Hotel Theater the Oscar nominees, see clips from the best pictures. We look forward to that. And those images are always so beautiful on the big screen. We're going to talk about the cinematography category momentarily. But to get your tickets for the event, visit kpecc.org/in-person, joined on Film Week by critics Peter Rayner and Christy Lemire. Let's talk about the best cinematography category and where we have some repeats of the foreign language films that we were just talking about, including Roma, of course. Alfonso Cuarón, he shot the film himself, right?
He did.
Yeah.
Exquisite black and white. It's so beautiful. I mean, from the very first shot, you know you are in the hands of a master, and which we knew anyway with Alfonso Cuarón. It's in black and white, as is another nominee.
The very first shot is dog pooping. Which
you don't know at first.
Right.
No.
It's subtle.
Elegant. The cleaning.
It's subtle. Right.
You made the point, though, Peter, if I recall, that it's almost self-consciously arty in some places. And there were times with the very artistic pans and things like that, I felt myself sort of noticing the showiness of the cinematography.
Right. Yeah, I did feel sort of abstracted from parts of this film because of the way it was shot, you know, the slow, long tracks. Also, the way he shoots most of it in medium shot, so that you don't often really see a lot of close-ups for a long time. You don't really know what anybody looks like. I found it a little too... The artifice in this film, I think, was a little bit distracting for me.
I found the way it was shot to be totally germane to the story he was trying to tell, and the way this family is evolving as this Cleo, the nanny in the middle of it, as her life is evolving as well. It made sense to me.
Emmanuel Lubezki is his normal cinematographer, and he was unavailable at the end to shoot this. Chivo, he's called. He's won the Oscar several times. So Cuarón ended up shooting it himself. He's also he can do editing them or screenplay, directing, and cinematography. He's all been nominated for.
He could win five Oscars that night, theoretically.
Yeah.
Wow. If only he would have acted in his film.
Well,
since
the
he's
little
telling
boy
a story.
Is right.
Right. That's his stand-in. Roma, of course, rated R. It's in selected theaters, streaming on Netflix. The Favorite from director Yorgos Lanthimos. Deborah Davis, Tony McNamara co-wrote the screenplay, but the cinematographer, for Robbie Ryan, is who we're talking about, Oscar nominated here. Peter?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of The Favorite. I mean, it's not one of my favorite movies. So I do think the best thing about it, aside from some of the performances, is the cinematography and the production design, which really lights up the whole set piece. It's kind of like a wacko Barry Lyndon in some ways, this movie, which is also incredibly well shot by the late Joan Alcott. So, you know, I think you can certainly sit back and luxuriate in the way this movie looks. The other aspects of it, I won't get into.
But what do you think of Robbie Ryan's cinematography, Christy?
Well, The Favorite is my favorite movie of the year. So I would love to see it win as many categories as it can. What I love about the way it's shot is that it looks like a very traditional, very staid period piece. And then over and over again, it breaks away from your expectations of how a film like this is going to be shot, with the long tracking shots, with the fisheye lenses. It's so bracingly alive, and it moves in a way that is so exciting and puts you on edge. So I would love to see this win.
Well, what he tries to do is, you know, you make a period film, but you don't make it look like a period film.
The Favorite, Robbie Ryan, nominated for Best Cinematographer. We're talking about that category. Also nominated, Maddie Libatique of A Star Is Born. Christy.
A Star Is Born is very pretty, and it really puts you in the middle of these big concert scenes, which are so important as far as establishing what that relationship is like between Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper's characters. You feel like you're in the middle of it in big, glossy, shiny ways. It's not going to win, but I'm a big fan of Matthew Libatique in general. He shoots a lot of Spike Lee's films.
Yeah, especially the, as you say, the concert scenes. The opening sequence, the musical number that starts out, is such a whiz-bang piece of everything that it kind of, you know, it's not exactly a letdown afterwards, but it's a really bang-pow way to open a movie. Beautifully shot.
A Star Is Born, again, nominated for Best Cinematography, Maddie Libatique. Cold War, that we talked about last segment, as a Best Foreign Language nominee. Here, Lukasz Zal, the cinematographer who's nominated in this category. Peter, Cold War cinematography?
Yeah, it's again, as with Ida, it's very, you know, beautifully controlled, black and white. It's great to see black and white movies. You know, I mean, it was such an art, and I'm never quite understanding why it's gone away. I understand for commercial reasons, but a lot of black and white films that have come out have done very well commercially.
Well, The Artist, just a few years ago.
Best Picture.
And Manhattan, of course, just gorgeous.
I mean, always. You know, you go back to Last Picture Show, there's a lot of films that really could benefit from it.
And it's shot in Academy ratio.
Which is?
It's boxier. For those of you listening at home, it's more like a box than a widescreen image. But the black and white here is really evocative of a time and place. But there's also such a sparseness and a spare nature to it that you really feel like you are there with them. There's an intimacy that the black and white helps create.
Lukasz Zal, Oscar nominated for Best Cinematography for Pavel Pawlikowski's film Cold War. And our guest last week on Film Week, talking about the best shot films of all time, himself, Oscar-nominated cinematographer Caleb Deschanel, nominated again for Never Look Away, the German film. Christy, your thoughts on Caleb's work here?
It's very beautiful in a very traditional kind of historical epic way. There are some shots at night. There's a bluish tinge to some of the shots at night that is very melancholy and kind of gorgeous. I like it. I don't think it's going to win, but it's a beautiful film.
I believe this is the first foreign language film that Deschanel has shot in his long career. He's been nominated for the Oscar 5 times. He should have won for Black Stallion, no question, for Right Stuff.
Speaking of gorgeous
films. He's a great cinematographer who's had an amazing career.
So is there a film here, Peter, you mentioned your one in foreign language you thought was a gross omission. What about in this category?
Well, Burning, I think, is remarkably well shot, and I think...
South Korean film.
I don't see the kind of egregious gaps here that I did in some of the other categories. Cinematography, as a rule, is a very strong category in movies, as with acting, too. I mean, it's very rare to see a movie now that's badly shot, it seems.
Although we discussed a few of them earlier on the show today.
It is January. Dead Ant.
The cinematographer, the director, though?
Yeah.
It's hard to know.
Well, and also, film is rarely shown, is rarely used now. It's all digital.
I would also say Burning is an omission here, but everything here is unimpeachable. They all belong.
All right. So Burning's cinematographer you would have liked to have seen nominated. All right. My thanks to our Film Week critics this week, Christy Lemire and Peter Rayner. I'm Larry Mantle, inviting you to join us as we're going to be with you at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown L.A., on Sunday afternoon, February 17th, our 17th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. You can get your tickets now at kpcc.org/in-person. From all of us at Film Week, have a wonderful weekend. We sure hope to see you at the theater at Ace Hotel. We'll be back with you next week with all the brand new movies to be reviewed. Have a great day.